We begin this evening with jazz. At the beginning of the 20th century, the world was witness to a war that brought destruction and loss never before experienced. But it was also witness to a new musical phenomenon, which seemed to arrive just when people needed respite from the devastation of World War I. The jazz craze spread and made its way to Ireland, which at that time, of course, was going through much political change.
While the cultural purists may have perceived that others were guilty of jazzing the soul of the nation away, for those participating in this immensely popular social activity, nationality does not appear to have been at stake.
I'm joined from our Cork studio by Dr. Ruth Stanley, a musician and musicologist who has researched the history of jazz in Ireland in the opening decades of the 20th century.
Well, the earliest known use of jazz as a distinct term in Irish society dates from September 1918, when a small notice appeared in the Belfast newsletter advertising tuition in Belfast in the latest dances, including the jazz. And 4 days later, the Freeman's Journal published a separate advertisement in Dublin for dance tuition in the American jazz. So jazz was primarily perceived as a dance genre in Ireland.
On New Year's Eve, 1918, a victory ball was hosted in Dublin Castle to celebrate the triumph of the Allied forces in World War I. A representative was present from every Irish regiment, and the music and entertainment included a jazz band from the US Naval Air Station in Wexford.
The Evening Herald reported that the combination was conducted by Petty Officer Gordon and played, quote, the raggy stuff with characteristic verve. Notably, the correspondent perceived jazz primarily as a dance craze, with the jazz fever appealing to both young and old. A female dance instructor was interviewed, and she stated that the dance step known as the jazz roll was surpassing the craze for tango. She said the steps are gliding, serpentine-like, with a rolling movement to the shoulders. It's a languid sort of dance and not at all tiring to do. This fact explains why so many badly wounded men and shell shock cases are to be found amongst the jazzers and jazz pupils.
In the years that followed, the unrest caused by the War of Independence and the Civil War discouraged touring jazz bands from visiting Ireland.
In these years, in 1919, the Southern Syncopated Orchestra and the original Dixieland Jazz Band travelled to mainland Britain, but they didn't come to Ireland at that time. Even so, jazz continued to evolve in Ireland in spite of adversity, with a notable increase in the number of local jazz bands providing accompaniment for the ubiquitously popular pastime of dancing. So newspapers advertise miscellaneous bands in counties Carlow, Cork, Fermanagh, Galway, Tipperary, Waterford and Westmeath, not to mention Dublin and Belfast, and I suspect in time my research will show that most, if not all, of the 32 counties had jazz bands during this period.
One case before the courts in late 1919 exposes some of the tensions in Irish society at the time. Newspapers reported on court hearings involving James Parnell Mandeville, who was applying for a dancing licence at 35 Dawson Street in Dublin.
Mandeville was a prominent Anglo-Irishman who was based in Annarcastle in Clonmel. He'd served in the Navy in World War I. Three other members of his jazz band had also served through the war, which, according to Mandeville, quote, might account for the bitter opposition being made to his application. There were also racial objections to his band. Two of his band members were black musicians from London, and a local dance band musician in Dublin, John Clark Barry, declared, quote, the distortions introduced by the coloured members make the music vulgar. Exaggerated jazz music is most decidedly suggestive and indecent. And aside from all of this, Mandeville's jazz band experienced objections from the Irish Vigilance Association. A representative there declared that, quote, the jazz has been hunted out of decent ballrooms in Paris and London and should not be tolerated in Dublin.
So jazz was even at this stage falling foul of the anti-enjoyment brigade, I suppose you could call them.
Yes, and this wasn't exclusive to Ireland, to be fair. This was very typical of the response in America, in Britain and Europe. Newspapers revealed that there was a steady stream of jazz bands touring throughout Ireland and Northern Ireland during the 20s and 30s. So from 1926 to 1930, the American musician Noble Sissel was a regular visitor to Dublin and Belfast. The warmth of his reception among Irish audiences led Sissel to quip that he felt like calling himself Noble O'Sissel.
In Ireland, political and cultural nationalism went hand in hand, and as Gaelic culture was revitalised, there was a suspicion and increasing rejection of any new cultural imports,
including cinema, music hall and jazz. And notwithstanding the American roots of much of this popular entertainment, it is striking that critics frequently blamed Great Britain for its propagation, and such an oversimplification was frankly convenient within an Irish-Ireland ideology that promoted political, economic and cultural independence from British imperialism.
Nowadays, the notion of politicians getting involved in a form of music seems absolutely absurd. But in a newly independent Ireland, the jazz craze didn't go unnoticed in government circles.
And there are quite a few discussions that appear in the Doyle debates. For example, the Fianna Fáil politician Sean T. O'Kelly, during a debate in 1933, said, "The cult of the jazz shop is, I think, affecting very considerably and in a not very pleasant way the disposition of our people."
There were also stern remarks from the bench from a District Justice Gough, who made a fairly dramatic statement.
Justice Gough was very well known for his vociferous opinions at the time on many moral matters, and in relation to jazz, and he spoke about jazz quite frequently, he said, "I'm afraid that the influence of this jazz dancing and the influence of the cinema have been very bad. They have made a terrible number of people abnormal, and these people, whom I might call jazz addicts, have lost control of themselves. In fact, you will see them on the streets, in the railway carriages and on the tramway cars, and they cannot keep quiet. Their bodies are being moved about and are swaying to some imaginary jazz rhythm." But Justice Gough held a lot of power because he was involved in granting dancing licences, so his opinions mattered.
Radio, of course, played an important role in spreading the popularity of jazz, though it may have been easier to get a record played on the BBC than on Radio Éireann.
So the BBC was largely an independent enterprise, while Irish Radio, or Radio Éireann, was established as a state service under direct control of the Irish Post Office, which meant that the government had more say in what was being broadcast. In spite of much resistance towards jazz broadcasts on Radio Éireann, there was never a formal ban, though the Minister for Posts and Telegraphs, PJ Little, would place severe restrictions on broadcasts of swing, jive, hot jazz and crooning during the 1940s. And going back to the opinions of politicians, it's important to state here there's not a real consensus. Notwithstanding some of the more conservative viewpoints, there was a notable lack of consensus among politicians, the more liberal of whom resisted any authoritarian approach to broadcasting. And I can quote here the Fine Gael politician James Dillon, who condemned Minister Little for his attempts to control music broadcasts on Radio Éireann.
Despite the hand-wringing, a steady stream of jazz bands toured Ireland north and south throughout the 1920s and 30s. But the objections continued from many sides, and chief among them were the Church, the Gaelic League and the GAA.
And the height of the anti-jazz crusade, of course, was in 1934. For Gaelic revivalists, it was reprehensible to uphold Gaelic values on the one hand while supporting British imported culture on the other. And there was considerable control exerted to preserve the alleged purity of Gaelic culture, as exemplified in the Gaelic Athletic Association's famous prohibition on playing or even being a spectator of what they termed foreign games. What's not so well known is that the GAA also sought to prohibit its members' clubs from hosting so-called foreign dances at GAA functions. But in practice, there was a striking degree of non-compliance by its members, and the GAA was unable to enforce the ruling across the island. So at the Ulster Council's convention of the GAA in 1930, one delegate averred that he preferred, quote, "a man who goes to Irish dances and plays soccer to the man who plays Gaelic football and goes to jazz dances. Jazz dances are the hallmark of shoneyism." And it really was an indication of the pervasiveness of jazz dancing in Irish and Northern Irish society that such a conservative institution as the GAA failed to suppress the activity within its own ranks.
And of course, eventually it was supplanted by the even more evil rock and roll. Ruth Stanley, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The History Show this evening to talk about your research on the history of jazz in Ireland.
Thank you.